Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hope everybody.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino
is doing their best right now as we're going through this crazy time in our world. I'm Tony Bruschi, host of Real Ghost Stories Online. I wanted to invite you and let you know about our other brand new podcast that we just launched, Help Kill the Time for you. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's about true crime and dark history. We dive into some of the strangest, most disturbed minds and experiences from our history, and examine their story, their Wikipedia entry, and then discuss the cases, the individuals, and the psychology of the events as we go through each and every story. Some of our first episodes include Ed Gein, the BTK killer, the New London school explosion, Amityville murders, Richard Speck, Amelia Dyer, the General Slocum disaster, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more. New episodes every single week. Check out Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search it. Subscribe wherever you download podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. It's available now with new episodes every single week. Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search and subscribe today and stay safe out there. If you've ever driven over a bridge, you may have wondered just how safe is this crossing. The horror and answer was realized one fateful day in 2007, high above the Mississippi in Minneapolis, as a bridge thousands of travelers a day believed to be secure collapsed, claiming the lives of many. Today, the Minneapolis bridge collapse on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The I-35 Mississippi River Bridge, officially known as Bridge 9340, was an eight-lane steel truss arch bridge that carried Interstate 35W across the St. Anthony Falls of the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The bridge opened in 1967 and was Minnesota's third busiest, carrying 140,000 vehicles daily. It had a catastrophic failure during the evening rush hour on August 1, 2007, killing 13 people and injuring 145. The NTSB cited a design flaw as the likely cause of the collapse, noting that a too thin gusset plate ripped along the lines of the rivets. An additional weight on the bridge at the time contributed to the catastrophic failure. Help came immediately from mutual aid in the 7-county Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area and emergency response personnel, charities, and volunteers. Within a few days of the collapse, the Minnesota Department of Transportation planned its replacement with the I-35W St. Anthony Falls Bridge. Construction on the replacement bridge completed quickly, opening on September 18, 2008. The bridge was located in Minneapolis, Minnesota's largest city, and connected the neighborhoods of downtown East and Marcy Homes. The south abutment was northeast of the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome, and the north abutment was northwest of the University of Minnesota East Bank campus. The bridge was the southeastern boundary of the Mississippi Mile, downtown riverfront parkland. Downstream is the 10th Avenue Bridge, once known as the Cedar Avenue Bridge. Immediately upstream is the lock and dam at St. Anthony Falls, where Minneapolis began. The first bridge upstream is a historic stone arch bridge built for the Great Northern Railway and now used for bicycle and pedestrian traffic. The north foundation pier of the bridge was near a hydroelectric plant that was raised in 1988. The south abutment was in an area polluted by a coal gas processing plant and a facility for storing and processing petroleum products. These uses effectively created a toxic waste site under the bridge, leading to a lawsuit and the removal of the contaminated soil. No relationship has been claimed between these previous uses and the bridge failure. So, Dark Side of Wikipedia today, talking about the Minneapolis bridge collapse of 2007, which is hard to believe it was that far in the past. Tony and Sean on today's episode. What's your memories of when this story broke all the way back in 2007?
Such that feeling you get in the pit of your stomach when it could be you forgot to close the garage and you're out on a flight for work or something far worse. But when you talked about that, we were going to talk about this today, my stomach had that gut-wrenching feeling. As we look at things that have happened a lot closer in recent memory, that absolute helplessness feeling is there. I remember seeing this and I saw it on the news, and then it was released very quickly after. There was surveillance video where it was a positioned camera, and you could just see the bridge is there, cars are driving, and then the bridge isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just very, very vivid memories that, albeit 13 years ago, it kind of feels like it happened 13 hours ago. It's still that fresh in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, I think I was on the air when it happened, and it was one of those, you know, you break in stories, and I was in Kansas when this happened, but I had gone over this bridge many a times when I lived in central Wisconsin and would go to Minneapolis. It's just kind of one of those main thoroughfares that you take, and I've always had a thing about bridges where you just kind of, you know, you're like, this is kind of, you know, it's more so, I think, mental. At least it was for a long time until you, after this bridge collapse, started realizing how horrible America's infrastructure had gotten. And then bridges everywhere were suddenly like shut down for about a week. And then they put a little quikrete in there and called it good. But it was scary. It was scary to think about a main thoroughfare like that you could have it be so, I guess, not inspected enough or to the point where you even have a possibility of collapse. And it's to still be using it. A lot of things, you know, a lot of red flags were raised right after this happened. Speaking on this, 13 years later, or is it, what are we at? It was 2007. So what is this? 13, 14? What is it years later? I don't know that it was a wake up call enough for the rest of America to go and say, we better fix our fucking bridges, because that's something that I think about every time now when I look at a bridge, or if you're in like a large metro area and you kind of got those big flyovers and everything, and you can really, you're seeing like the lower end of the bridge, and you see the ruptured state that it's in with concrete kind of falling and girders that are rusted to shit and bolts that are on the ground. And I mean, some cities are in great shape, some areas are not. And it's just like, oh my God, what are we doing here? There's one in St. Louis. It's a couple in St. Louis that I feel that way about when I drive over by the arch. And I don't know what, I mean, this is just me, not an expert in anything on the subject of bridge safety, but there's some that just, you're like, all right, here we go. Let's hope it's not the hour of collapse.
And I think it comes of where you're consuming this. Both of us from the Midwest, we obviously have driven over this specific bridge, and it hits a little bit more of a personal chord.
Yeah.
Both of our careers have taken us to a few parts of the country. When I was down in Little Rock, Arkansas, it was a planned demolition of the Broadway Bridge. It was over 100 years old, and they just had it planned through the State Department of Transportation to put a new bridge in. Well, they use dynamite on this bridge. It was a big event and local TV was covering it. Well, they detonated the dynamite and the bridge didn't go into the river.
I remember that.
No, fuck you. I am a strong bridge. I am strong like bull. And they, I mean, this was a multi-day thing. There were t-shirts made that I hope my relationship is strong as the Broadway Bridge. And it just didn't want to go down. So finally they had to bring in a barge and some type of pulley system where they literally had to pull it down because it imploded upon itself and it was just so strong and solid. So for every bridge that is faulty or it looks as though it's going to the next storm, it's going to fall apart, there are some structures out there that appear not as strong, but clearly are. So
yeah.
It's scary nonetheless every time you go over a bridge. It's just for me, I don't ever want to be in a rush hour situation where I'm stuck on the bridge. Driving over,
yeah.
Okay. Like, if it falls, well, I'll just floor it and I'll get over. But if you're just sitting there like a waiting to have something happen, that still to this day makes me a little on edge.
I think of this every time I go over a bridge. And I'll share more bridge, more of Tony's bridge anxieties.
On the Hallmark Channel next. Oh, we're not talking about the game bridge.
We're talking
about actual bridges.
As we continue on with this this story, let's hear more about the Minneapolis bridge collapse. The bridge, officially designated Bridge 9340, was designed by Servdup and Parcell in 1961. The American Association of State Highway Officials, now American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. Standard specifications. The construction contracts, worth in total more than $5.2 million at the time, were initially offered to Hercon Inc. and Industrial Construction Company. Hercon expressed concern about the project, reporting that one portion of the bridge, Pier 6, could not be built as planned. After failed discussions with MnDOT, Hercon backed out of the project altogether. Construction on the bridge began in 1964 and the structure was completed and opened to traffic in 1967, during an era of large-scale projects to build the Twin Cities freeway system. When the bridge fell, it was still the most recent river crossing built on a new site in Minneapolis. After the building boom ebbed during the 1970s, infrastructure management shifted towards inspection and maintenance. The bridge's 14 spans extended 1,907 feet long. The three main spans were a deck truss construction, while all but two of the 11 approach spans were steel multi-girder construction, the two exceptions being concrete slab construction. The piers were not built in the navigation channel. Instead, the center span of the bridge consisted of a single 458-foot steel arch truss over the 390-foot channel. The two support piers for the main trusses, each with two load-bearing concrete pylons at either side of the center main span, were located on opposite banks of the river. The center span was connected to the north and south approaches by shorter spans formed by the same main trusses. Each was a 266-foot in length and connected to the approach spans by a 38-foot cantilever. The two main trusses on one on either side ranged in depth from 60 feet above their pier and concrete pylon supports to 36 feet at mid-span on the center span and 30 feet deep at the outer ends of the adjoining spans. At the top of the main trusses were the deck trusses, 12 feet in depth and integral with the main trusses. The transverse deck beams, part of the deck trusses, rested on top of the main trusses. These deck beams supported longitudinal deck stringers 27 inches in depth and reinforced concrete pavement. The deck was 113 feet 4 inches in breadth and was split longitudinally. It had transverse expansion joints at the centers and ends of each of the three main spans. The roadway deck was approximately 115 feet above the water level. On December 9th, 1985, the temperature reached negative 30 in Minneapolis Fahrenheit. Vehicles coming across the bridge experienced black ice, and there was a major pileup on the bridge on the northbound side. In February and December of 1996, the bridge was identified as the single most treacherous cold weather spot in the Twin Cities freeway system. Because of the almost frictionless thin layer of black ice that regularly formed when temperatures dropped below freezing, the bridge's proximity to St. Anthony Falls contributed significantly to the icing problem, and the site was noted for frequent spinouts and collisions. By January of 1999, Minnesota DOT began testing magnesium chloride solutions and a mixture of magnesium chloride and a corn processing byproduct to see whether either would reduce the black ice that appeared on the bridge during the winter months. In October of 1999, the state embedded temperature-activated nozzles in the bridge deck to spray the bridge with potassium acetate solution to keep the area free of winter black ice. The system came into operation in the year 2000. Although there were no additional major multi-vehicle collisions after the automated de-icing system was installed, it's been raised as a possibility that the potassium may have contributed to the collapse of the bridge by corroding the structural supports. Though the NTSB's final report found that the corrosion was not a contributing factor. Since 1993, the bridge was inspected annually by MNDOT, although no inspection report was completed in 2007 due to the construction work. In the years prior to the collapse, several reports cited problems with the bridge structure. In 1990, the federal government gave the I-35W bridge a rating of structurally deficient, citing significant corrosion in its bearings. Approximately 75,000 other U.S. bridges had this classification in 2007. According to a 2001 study by the Civil Engineering Department of the University of Minnesota, cracking had been previously discovered in the cross girders at the end of the approach spans. The main trusses connected to these cross girders and resistance to motion at the connection point bearings was leading to unanticipated out-of-plane distortion of the cross girders and subsequent stress cracking. The situation was addressed prior to the study by drilling the cracks to prevent further propagation and adding support struts to the cross girder to prevent further deterioration. The report also noted a concern about lack of redundancy in the main truss system, which meant the bridge had a greater risk of collapse in the event of any single structural failure. Although the report concluded that the bridge should not have any problems with fatigue cracking in the foreseeable future, regular inspection, structural health monitoring, and use of strain gauges had been suggested. In 2005, the bridge was again rated as structurally deficient and in possible need of replacement, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation's National Bridge Inventory Database. Problems were noted in two subsequent inspection reports. The inspection carried out June 15, 2006, found problems of cracking and fatigue. On August 2, 2007, Governor Tim Pawlenty stated that the bridge had been scheduled to be replaced in 2020. The I-35W bridge ranked near the bottom of the federal inspection ratings nationwide. Bridge inspectors used with the rating systems that ranges from the highest score of 100 to the lowest score 0. In 2005, they rated the bridge at 50, indicating that replacement may have been in order. Out of over 100,000 heavily used bridges, only about 4% scored below 50. On a separate measure, the I-35W bridge was rated structurally deficient, but was deemed to have met minimum tolerable limits to be left in place as is. In December 2006, a steel reinforcement project was planned for the bridge. However, the project was canceled in January 2007 in favor of periodic safety inspections after engineers realized that drilling for the retrofitting would, in fact, weaken the bridge. The internal Minnesota DOT document, bridge officials talked about the possibility of the bridge collapsing and worried that they might have to condemn it. The construction taking place in the weeks prior to the collapse included joint work and replacing lighting, concrete, and guardrails. At the time of the collapse, four of the eight lanes were closed for resurfacing, and there were 575,000 pounds of construction supplies and equipment on the bridge. And at 6.05 p.m. on Wednesday, August 1st, 2007, with rush hour bridge traffic moving slowly through the limited number of lanes, the central span of the bridge suddenly gave way, following by the adjoining spans. The structure and deck collapsed into the river and onto the riverbanks below, the southern part toppling 81 feet eastward in the process. Total of 111 vehicles were involved, sending their occupants and 18 construction workers as far as 115 feet down to the river or into its banks. Northern sections fell into a rail yard, landing on three unoccupied stationary freight cars. Sequential images of the collapse were taken by an outdoor security camera located at the parking lot entrance of the control facility for the Lower St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam. The immediate aftermath of the collapse was also captured by a Minnesota DOT traffic camera that was facing away from the bridge during the collapse itself. The federal government immediately launched a National Transportation Safety Board investigation. NTSB Chairman Mark Rosnicker, along with a number of investigators, arrived on scene 9 hours after the collapse. Rosnicker remained in Minneapolis for nearly 1 week, serving as the government's designated primary interface with federal, state, and local officials, as well as briefing the press on the status of the investigation. Mayor R.T. Rayback and Governor Tim Pawlenty declared a state of emergency for the city of Minneapolis and for the state of Minnesota. On August 2nd, 2007, Rayback's declaration was approved and extended indefinitely by the Minneapolis City Council the next day. As of the morning following the collapse, according to the White House Press Secretary Tony Snow, Minnesota had not requested a federal disaster declaration. President Bush pledged support during a visit to the site on August 4th with Minnesota elected officials and announced that the United States Secretary of Transportation, Mary Peters, would lead the rebuilding effort. Rayback and Pawlenty gave the president detailed requests for aid during a closed-door meeting. Local authorities were assisted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation evidence team and by United States Navy divers, who began arriving on August 5, 2007. This is just one of those stories where, you know, there's just utter government failure and failure on the parts of the people that we pay our taxes to, and the decision-making process and what is implemented and what is not implemented and what gets put to the side and what we just say is okay. And it's like, you know what? I want my fucking money back. You know, it's like any other part of the world where you put your money into a system and you pay for shit to work right, and this is what you get out of it, would not fucking work. It wouldn't happen. But somehow we have the biggest cluster. And I know there's plenty of corrupt governments and shit, but I think we are right up there when it comes to, well, pretty much anything involving the U.S. government. But it's like, what the fuck? Why do we have these systems in place? Why do we have inspectors? Why do we have people that go around as their job and departments that go, this bridge isn't safe, that bridge isn't safe? If in the end, all it is words on a piece of paper and nothing ever fucking gets done. I mean, it's like that with so many things, like health inspectors and stuff. I've been told, you know, you call in like a health inspection report in some cities about a restaurant. They're like, yeah, there's one inspector for like 500,000 people or something. It's like, oh, well, that's why everybody gets food poisoning at this one place, because the wait to get the inspector in there is like 7 years. It's just, it's insane. It is insane. The bureaucratic stuff that we have in our country, and I think we're seeing a lot of it right now with coronavirus and just the utter incompetence of how do we get from, you know, the right hand to work with the left hand. You know, this shit isn't new that the government's been incompetent. It's always been incompetent. It does enough to kind of scrap to get by. And then people go, oh, yes, it's kind of working. And then, whoops, bridge collapsed. This is fucked up.
The fact that there's minimums and hitting the minimums, but being really close to the minimum, I don't know enough about safety and construction and such, but why is there minimums and you can note a bridge is structurally deficient and fatigue cracking? In my mind, and what I know, which is not, if it hits the minimum standards, but it has fatigue cracking and specific suggestions to add some work to it, how does that happen? And then furthermore, and I understand you got to plan, you can't just put up a bridge in a month, but 13 years? I mean, August of 2007, yep, we're going to replace this bridge in 2020. I just,
how is that the acceptable answer?
I mean, I would imagine, you know, 5 years out, you got to raise money or taxes or a hike, but 13 years when it is just hitting the minimum standards and there is back-to-back reviews that say there's fatigue cracking and it's kind of a known deal. Hey, this bridge, it's kind of lived its life. At this time, it's 40 years old. Let's put these plans in place. And what is a little bit of a aloof to me is, you know, this bridge is weakened. You know, you can't retrofit it because it will weaken the bridge. Why do you have 567 pounds of construction equipment on the bridge? And if you're going to do that, why do you keep it open?
And you keep doing shit that you know is not safe for the bridge.
You're asking for it to collapse.
Yeah.
I can understand what they were doing, but then you close the bridge or you, yeah, during peak rush hour times,
yeah,
you maybe have one lane open in one direction. Yeah, I understand it's the main thoroughfare in a major metropolitan city, but I mean, frustrated people taking a little bit longer to get home and to work, or 13 people die.
Well, does it all come down to voters? Does it all come down to, well, if we did shut this bridge down, you're going to piss off a lot of commuters, 150,000 vehicles a day.
And I guess we can take maybe, yeah, a dozen and a half deaths,
yeah,
opposed to upwards of millions of people not voting me, yeah, into my next term.
Yeah. And they'll blame something else. They won't necessarily blame the mayor or the governor or anything like that. They'll blame, you know, the bridge. They'll blame the construction company 40 years ago. They'll blame all sorts of shit, you know, and all of it probably playing a big part into it. But the one company I found it very interesting that when they were constructing the damn thing in the 60s said, no, we can't do this the way you want. It's not safe. We're out. And then they kept digging around going, oh, we'll find a company that'll take the fucking bid. And they did. And then they built it the way they wanted. It's, you know, I hate shit like that. I detest businesses that function in that way, where it's like, we'll take the scraps. It doesn't matter if it's not quite what it should be or is safe to do, but we'll get the money. Yeah, you will. And it's, you know damn well, though, structurally, this is not a sound project. Maybe it'll last for a little while, but shit's going to hit the fan at some point. I mean, I don't know. There's just so many things here. It's like saying, okay, it's just the acceptable answer here with, was it the governor or the mayor that was saying that it was going to be like 13 years from now, we'll build the new bridge. The governor saying that. So would the governor also accept the answer of, well, I'm sorry, you know, 2/3 of the governor's mansion currently on fire. The fire detectors are going off. The alarms are going off. Sprinkler systems are going off. We see visible flames and smoke from miles away, but we plan on letting the fire department come to your residence
in 2020.
Yeah. In approximately 4 years, you know, it's like, no, this is on fire right now. It does. You can't, like, well, once it's a complete pile of ashes, then we'll fix it. And we're not, and you need to stay in the structure the whole time because it's your house and you're not allowed to go out. So, you know,
now here's the deal. You have 4 children, right? So 2, yeah, of them may perish, but hey, you'll still have the 2 others.
Yeah, it's okay. You know, we're going to, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul here to make this make sense. And I'm sure it comes down to finance and shit, but it's like, what the fuck? You know, people can be resourceful. Fuck, they live in Minnesota. They go through a lot of stuff with winter traffic and driving, and they are resourceful folks. I'm from that neck of the woods. Is it an inconvenience to not be able to go over a bridge? Yes. But you know what? Every fucking one of them will go to the bridge that's safe if you tell them this one might collapse. it's just like, what the fuck? There's no words. It just doesn't register in my mind the level of incompetence that just exists and just runs abound in this story. Let's continue on with the 2007 bridge collapse in Minneapolis. 13 people were killed in the collapse. Triage centers at the ends of the bridge routed 50 victims to area hospitals. Some in trucks and ambulances were in short supply. Many of the injured had blunt trauma injuries. Those near the south end were taken to Hepin County Medical Center. Those near the north end to Fairview University Medical Center and other hospitals. At least 22 children were injured. 13 children were treated at Children's Hospital and Clinics of Minnesota, 5 at HCMC, and 4 or 5 at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. During the first 40 hours, 11 area hospitals treated 98 victims. Only a few of the vehicles were submerged, but many people were stranded on the collapsed sections of the bridge. Several vehicles caught fire, including a semi-truck trailer, from which the driver's body was later recovered. When fire crews arrived, they had to route hoses from several blocks away. A school bus carrying 63 children ended up resting precariously against the guardrail of the collapsed structure near the burning semi-truck trailer. The children were returning from a field trip to a water park as part of the Waite House Neighborhood Center day camp based in Phillips community. Jeremy Hernandez, a 20-year-old staff member on the bus, assisted many of the children by kicking out the rear emergency exit and escorting or carrying them to safety. One youth worker was severely injured. Civilians immediately took part in the rescue efforts. Minneapolis and Hennepin County received mutual aid from neighboring cities and counties throughout the metropolitan area. The Minneapolis Fire Department arrived in 6 minutes and responded quickly, helping people who were trapped in their vehicles. They took 81 minutes to triage and transport 145 patients with the help of the Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial, and Alena Paramedics. By the next morning, they had shifted their focus to the recovery of bodies, with several vehicles known to be trapped under the debris and several people still unaccounted for. 20 divers organized by the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office used side-scan sonar to locate vehicles submerged in the murky water. Their efforts were hampered by debris and challenging currents. The United States Army Corps of Engineers lowered the river level by 2 feet downriver at Ford Dam to allow easier access to vehicles in the water. Carl Bolander and Sons, a St. Paul-based earthworks and demolition company, brought in several cranes and other heavy machinery to assist in cleaning debris for rescue workers. Emergency personnel running on the collapsed bridge and two Minneapolis Fire Department boats in the water, with dozens of observers on the bank of the Mississippi and Minneapolis Fire Department, created the National Incident Management System Command Center in the parking lot of the American Red Cross and an adjacent printing company on the West Bank. The Minneapolis Police Department, Minnesota State Patrol, and the University of Minnesota Police secured the area. MFD managed the ground operations, and HCSO was in charge of the water operation. The city provided 75 firefighters and 75 law enforcement units. Rescue victims stranded at the bridge were complete in 3 hours. We had a state bridge in a county river between two banks of a city. But we didn't have one problem with any of these issues because we knew who was in charge of the assets, said Rocco Forte, city engineer, who was also the preparedness director of the city metropolitan area. County and state employees at all levels knew their roles and had practiced them since the city received FEMA emergency management training the year following the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Their rapid response time is also credited to the Minnesota United States Department of Homeland Security investment in the 800 millihertz mobile radio communications that were operating in Minneapolis and three of the responding counties. The City of Minneapolis Collapsed Structures Rescue and Dive Team and the Emergency Operations Center established at 6:20 p.m. in Minneapolis City Hall. Recovery of deceased victims took over 3 weeks. At the request of the NTSB Chairman Mark Rosnicker, the U.S. Navy sent 17 divers and 5-person command and control elements from its Mobile Diving and Salvage Unit 2. Divers and underwater search evidence response teams from the FBI joined the response efforts on August 7th, bringing with them truckloads of specialized equipment, including FBI-provided side-scan sonar and 2 submarines. The Navy dive team started diving operations in the river at 2 a.m., within hours of arriving, and conducted operations around the clock for the next 3 weeks until the recovery portion of the mission was completed. The FBI teams had planned to search with an unmanned submarine, but had to abandon this plan after they found it was too big to maneuver in the debris field and cloudy water. Minneapolis Police Captain Mike Martin stated that the public safety divers are trained up to a level where they can kind of pick the low-hanging fruit. They can do the stuff that's easy. The bodies that are in the areas where they can sweep shore to shore, the vehicles that they can get into and search that weren't crushed, they were able to remove some of those. Now what we're looking at is the vehicles that are under the bridge deck and the structural pieces. 75 local, state, and federal agencies were involved in the rescue and recovery, including emergency personnel and volunteers from the counties of Encoa, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Scott, Washington, Winona, Wright in Minnesota, and St. Croix County in Wisconsin. The St. Croix EMS rescue dive team and others were standing by. Federal assistance came from the United States Department of Defense, DHS, USACE, and the United States Coast Guard. Adventure Divers in Minot, North Dakota, it's a private firm who assisted with local authorities. You know, here's the thing that we're good at. We're good at coming in during a rescue operation as a people, as a nation, and because people are wanting to help. I mean, so when shit hits the fan like this or like 9/11 or something like that, our first responders are brave. They're great. You don't usually see a whole lot of issues there of people who are saying, no, I'm not going to go fuck around with that. They're there. They're putting their lives on the line. So those parts of government seem to be, in many cases, you know, functional, although the argument can be made sometimes right now with some cities that are somewhat under siege where there's no law enforcement or anything of that nature. There are situations like this, though, where we're great at responding. But we wouldn't have to be in those situations or in that boat. And I'm not trying to make a pun here. If we just fucking heeded the warnings to begin with. That's where my mind always goes. It always goes to like the core of whatever the fuck the problem is. Not, well, how do we put the Band-Aid on it? How do we fix it after it breaks? How do we prevent it from breaking in the first place? And there needs to be more focus on that in everything that we are doing in this country. How do we stop the fucking problem to begin with rather than how are we going to Band-Aid this shit show up? Because that's what we've been good at historically. I don't know how great we're going to be going forward, especially when there's no clear path to how to do half of this shit, depending on the situation.
By the Minneapolis Fire Department, 145 patients they triaged and transported 81 minutes. That's less than a minute and 40 seconds per patient.
Yeah, and they did great.
In 15 minutes, the bridge collapsed at 6:05. By 6:20, there was an emergency op center established at City Hall. So, yeah, there was flags everywhere saying this bridge is probably shouldn't be driven on, probably shouldn't stand on, probably shouldn't skip rocks from it. But that being out of control,
if it happens, we're here. You know, like nobody. It, God bless the people who went and helped and did the emergency response. But it's just like they all put their lives at risk too. All of it. None of it should have happened. They should have had to put their lives at risk. These people shouldn't have died. The bridge shouldn't have fucking collapsed. It should have been shut down well before. And obviously, well, hindsight's 20/20. Not really when you have all the evidence in front of you before it collapsed. It's not a hindsight thing. It's a responsibility thing. It's a, well, how do we finance this? How do we deal with this? What are we supposed to do? And the argument usually goes back to, well, you know, financing. We don't really have the money for that right now. Then close the fucking thing. Just because you don't have the money doesn't mean that you just keep going with it.
I also think that there are two types of people in this world. There are sayers. There are doers.
Sure.
You have first responders where they understand, the hardworking men and women, that they cannot control political, bureaucratic bourgeois.
No, they're there to do their job.
No matter how hard they try, no matter how loud, no matter how detailed they are in reports and inspections and this, that, or the other, it all comes down to talkers.
Yeah.
They are just going to be as sharpened and as finely tuned as they can where in some cases there may have been, it's just a matter of the day that this bridge collapses. But yeah. You know what? When it happens, we can control how many lives we save. Yeah. And if I had to pick, if I'm a talker or a doer, I would side with the latter, because politics and political people, it's corrupt for a reason. Yeah. Even the purest of pure people that want to make a change and make a difference, by the time you end up on the other end and you're known enough and people know you enough to want to vote for you, this, that, or the other, I'd like to think that you are not the pure driven human of when you started in politics. You have to kind of go through the laundry, if you will, and make deals to rise to a level that you are known on a national level. So with that being said, some stuff is, even though it's wrong, it's corrupt and it's fucked up, it's not going to change. And all you can do is be ready to react and do it to the best of your ability.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we as a collective society need to, I think, understand more of and be ready for more of, as far as individually. The attitude I think a lot of folks have had over the years was, you know, well, something goes wrong, well, there'll be a plan for that. There'll be a way to fix this. Yeah, I mean, there's emergency responders, sure, but there's so many things in our world that we don't have control over, and that just happen. You know, but there's many things when you have the warnings left and right in front of you. There's things that can be done that should be done to try and prevent them, especially when it's your own people saying bridge not safe to drive on, not safe.
It's not good. Don't drive on bridge.
I mean,
let's go drive on it.
You can make arguments of like, well, you know, they didn't know this or that, you know, with case by case, whatever you want to talk about. I mean, but there's this one to me is just like, it's black and white. It's in front of you. It says it here. It's not a generic note like that says Bin Laden determined to attack America a few days before 9/11. And then it happens. You know, okay, well, how is it going to happen? You can somewhat understand where it's like, well, they knew something was going to happen, but didn't have maybe the exact specifics there. I don't know. But this one, you have the fucking document saying this is what's going to collapse. This is going to be a problem. Fix it. Do something. Why the inaction on things that we have control over? It just boggles the mind. Let's continue on with the story of the Minneapolis bridge collapse. The National Transportation Safety Board immediately began a comprehensive investigation that was expected to take up to 18 months. Immediately following the collapse, Governor Pawlenty and Minnesota DOT announced that the Illinois-based engineering firm Wiss Jenny Elsner Associates had been selected to provide essential analysis that would parallel the investigation being conducted by the NTSB. 1 week after the collapse, workers were just beginning to move debris in vehicles to further the process of recovering victims. Cameras and motion detectors were added to the site around the bridge to ward off intruders who officials said were hindering the investigation. Hennepin County Sheriff Richard W. Stank stated, "We're treating this as a crime scene at this point. There's no indication there is any foul play involved. It's a crime scene until we can determine what was the cause of the collapse." An employee at the NTSB had written his doctoral thesis on possible failure scenarios of this specific bridge while he was a student at the nearby University of Minnesota. That thesis, including his computer model of the bridge for failure mode analysis, was used by the NTSB to aid its investigation. The Federal Highway Administration built a computer model of the bridge at the Turner Fairbank Highway Research Center in McLean, Virginia. NTSB investigators were particularly interested in learning why a part of the bridge's southern end shifted eastward as it collapsed, but this particular phenomenon was not germane to the ultimate cause of the collapse. Officials with DHS said there was no indication that terrorism was involved, although officials emphasized that the cause of the collapse had not yet been determined. Peters cautioned, states the, to remain mindful of the extra weight construction projects place on bridges. Within days, bridge inspectors were stepped up throughout the United States. FHWA advised states to inspect the 700 U.S. bridges of similar construction after identifying a possible design flaw related to large steel sheets called gusset plates, which connect girders in the truss structure. Officials raised questions as to why such a flaw would not have been discovered in over 40 years of inspections. The flaw was first discovered by Wiss Janey Elsner Associates, Inc., an independent consulting firm hired by the Minnesota Department of Transportation to investigate the cause of the collapse. On January 15th of 2008, the NTSB announced it had determined that the bridge's design specified steel gusset plates that were undersized and inadequate to support the intended load of the bridge, a load that had increased over time. This assertion was based on an interim report that calculated the demand-to-capacity ratio for the gusset plates. The NTSB recommended that similar bridge designs be reviewed for this problem. NTSB Chairman Mark Rosnicker said, "Although the board's investigation is still ongoing and no determination of probable cause has been reached, interim findings in the investigation have revealed a safety issue that warrants attention. During the wreckage recovery, investigators discovered the gusset plates at 8 different joint locations in the main center span were fractured. The board, with assistance from the FHWA, conducted a thorough review of the design of the bridge, with an emphasis on the design of the gusset plates. The review discovered that the original design process of the I-35W bridge led to a serious error in sizing some of the gusset plates in the main truss. On March 17, 2008, the NTSB announced an update on the investigation relating to load capacity, design issues, computer analysis, and modeling, digital imaging analysis, and analysis of the undersized and corroded gusset plates. The investigation revealed that photos from a June 2003 inspection of the bridge showed gusset plate bowing. On November 13, 2008, the NTSB released the findings of its investigation. The primary cause of the collapse was the undersized gusset plates at 0.5 inches thick. Contributing to that design or construction error was the fact that 2 inches of concrete had been added to the road surface over the years, increasing the static load by 20%. Another factor was the extraordinary weight of construction equipment and material resting on the bridge just above its weakest point at the time of the collapse. That load was estimated at 578,000 pounds, 262 tons, consisting of sand, water, and vehicles. The NTSB determined that corrosion was not a significant contributor, but that inspectors did not routinely check that safety features were, in fact, functional. So, there you go. I am honestly surprised that there have not been more bridge collapses like this in the United States since that time. I remember many bridges, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, being shut down seemingly temporarily right after, but it was only for like a week or two. And then I really kind of questioned when everything opened back up within that short period of time, and you really didn't see any sort of major construction going on most bridges. I'm sure some were retrofitted or whatever the hell they did. I'm sure there was work that was done on some bridges, but I don't think it was like, oh, the wake-up call. We really need to take a look at the infrastructure of the United States and do some fixing or just full-out rebuilding, create a program, create something almost like the original highway projects that built our systems to make sure that these things can continue to be functional into the future, because they're at their end unless they get torn down or rebuilt. You want to go on the ultimate scary bridge. There's one in, I believe it's in Arkansas. It's either Arkansas or in Missouri, and it's out kind of in the middle of nowhere. And it looks like almost like a mini Golden Gate Bridge. It's a big, what do you call it when it's got the big, the two main pillar type things on it? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's called a pillar type thing.
A pillar type thing bridge. I'm not good at describing my bridges in terms of what their technical terms are. But it's a beautiful old bridge. It's wooden. And when you're standing on the bank of the river that it crosses,
suspension.
Bridge. Yes, there's a simple, you know, second grade word I couldn't pull out of my ass.
The word is
suspension bridge. It's a suspension bridge. It's wooden, and when you're standing from a distance watching vehicles go over this suspension bridge, you can see it sag. as it, especially buses, which do go over this thing. And it's near Eureka Springs. We found it accidentally because we kind of got off route one day. And it's the neatest thing, but oh my God, I will never drive over it again. It is open to drive, but should it be? Probably not.
It's funny you mentioned the bridge sags. You can see vehicles, it sags. I'll tell you what else would sag if I went over this bridge. My pants. Because I would not have to go to the bathroom anymore after crapping myself out of fear if the bridge sags when I'm going over it in my Toyota Camry.
It's the Beaver Bridge, I believe is what it's called. If I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's a one lane. There's a Wikipedia on it.
Which is also comforting as well. Yeah, this bridge is only one lane now.
Yeah.
Because, well, we can't have cars going on at the same time in two directions. It may, you know, break.
The Beaver Bridge in Beaver, Arkansas is a historic one-lane suspension bridge carrying Arkansas Highway 187 over the White River at Table Rock Lake. Built in 1949 by the Pioneer Construction Company, this structure is the only suspension bridge open to traffic in Arkansas. The Beaver Bridge was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1990.
Yeah, there's a video of a bus going over it, and it literally looks like you're playing the piano. When you tickle the keys there, that's what the bridge is doing as the bus is going over it.
Oh, my God. Further rehabilitation occurred in 2003 on the bridge. The bridge has a 10-ton weight limit. The bridge was temporarily closed for inspection in October of 2018 after two overweight buses crossed it.
Why the hell are you taking the tour bus over this bridge?
It should just be a walking bridge. It's insane. It is insane. I mean, it probably doesn't get traveled too much because it literally is. It's like in the middle of nowhere. But there's a little like recreation area down off from the side of it, and people can swim in the river there. That's where we went and stopped afterwards and just looked at the bridge, and I took some pictures, and you could see the damn thing sagging with every vehicle that went over it. And it's a big bridge, and it's a long drop. You feel if your car went off that thing, good luck. I don't know that you'd make it. It's just like, why do we have this thing? I get it. You know, it's one of those, it's a historic bridge. Great. Don't make it for vehicle traffic anymore. I don't think it's good because very soon the short entry of this bridge, which is less than a page on Wikipedia, within 5 years will be an episode of Dark Side once it collapses. And then I'll go back to the tape and go, look, I called it. It's just fucked up. But that's one of the scariest bridges to me. You ever cross the Mackinac Bridge, the Mighty Mac up in Michigan?
No.
You haven't? Really?
No. Really?
Wow. I'm surprised from being up there. That is one hell of a bridge. That one has fascinated me forever. They are always working on that bridge. There is construction 365 days a year on that bridge. So they're always working to keep it up. So I feel safe on that bridge more than most bridges, but it is a scary ass bridge. It's bigger than the Golden Gate. If you don't know what I'm talking about, obviously you can look it up on your phone. It looks like the Golden Gate Bridge, but blue. And it's bigger than the Golden Gate Bridge. But it's a suspension bridge. Absolutely beautiful to see, especially if you're taking a picture of it or something from Mackinac Island, sitting up at the top of the Grand Hotel, looking at this thing and the sun setting. It's one of the neatest sights I've ever seen, in my personal opinion. But it is a scary ass bridge to go over, not because of fear of collapse, but because you're so damn high up. And when the winds are high, they actually shut the damn thing down because the Mackinac Bridge Authority will shut it down because vehicles have been blown off of the bridge in high winds.
I'm going to go ahead and just drive around.
I've driven the bridge. I've driven the bridge in high winds in a blizzard. And extremely low visibility. I had to go back to a funeral in Wisconsin. This is when I was living in Traverse City. And my only way back into Wisconsin at a reasonable pace, well, probably I should have gone the southern route, but normally it's the northern route. But I went through a blizzard and I went over that bridge at like 10 miles an hour. So it took like a half hour to get across the bridge because it's like 5 miles long. And it was one of the scariest drives of my life. The middle part of the bridge is steel girders or steel, not girders, steel. What am I looking for here? It's what you're driving over, like not plates, but almost like vents that allow airflow to go to and from the bridge. So it's not just like a kite where the bridge could just be lifted up by the wind. So you're driving over that. And that's where they have concern of vehicles flying off the bridge is in super high wind, something going truck. Underneath your truck and whoop, there you go. So right after I got over the bridge, they closed it. They shut the bridge down for I don't know how long until they felt it was safe. But I was one of the last vehicles over it that day. And it was like it was like 2007 around that time. I walked that bridge once, too. They once a year have a walk where you walk the bridge. They close the lane. And it's neat. It is one hell of a structure, and they do take great care of that bridge. There's an authority strictly for it, but interesting thing to walk over. Can't imagine it collapsing. I can't imagine, and I'm not saying that because it couldn't, but I'm saying I just can't imagine being on the bridge and having that happen. That's like a worst nightmare type scenario, which unfortunately the folks in Minnesota back when this happened in the early 2000s, they lived through that nightmare. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I hope you're not driving over a bridge right now listening to this.
I can't imagine the post-traumatic stress if you survive that. That would be a really difficult one to deal with. To travel, period, to go over bridges at all, that would be very, very difficult for me.
Look at bridges. I couldn't even look at a bridge.
No. I would be, I don't know. I don't know what the hell I would do. I don't think I'd be doing much traveling ever again just because I don't think my mind would allow it. It would be so stressful. Yeah. But that's the story of the Minneapolis bridge collapse. Another disturbing reality that we've dealt with in the last 20 years as of the recording of this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. That wraps up the show. If you like the show, press subscribe wherever it is you listen to us on. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.